My name is Ernest Figueroa. I'm a local director and playwright, a man of the theater. And as a man of the theater, I might want to recommend that you please turn off your cell phones and beepers at this time. I'm also a coordinator of the grants and special programs here for the city of Pasadena. And on behalf of the city of Pasadena, Mayor Bill Bogard, Jonathan Gless, our executive director of the arts, Claire Peeps, Angie Kim, myself, I want to thank you for allowing us to share with you our own culture jam of art and culture, the now sunny city of Pasadena. Just in time. I've been asked to introduce our third and final keynote speaker. I do want to mention, though, as we began our conference with one of our keynote speakers, gave us the spirit of aloha. And to Pu'ulani, we want to gratefully say mahalo for launching this conference with such grace. Yesterday, we heard the story of how a sultry singer-poet inspired a young Hispanic boy from Los Angeles. And to that young boy, we want to say, gracias, Luis. You inspired us. And now for our third keynote speaker, we have a man of mystery. And the mystery is how one man can accomplish so much and make it look so easy. Our speaker is the author of 19 critically acclaimed books. That's 19. And his works have been translated into 21 languages. His popular mystery feature, if you didn't get the pun before, featuring Easy Rollins, began with The Devil in the Blue Dress in 1990. Others in this series include A Red Death, White Butterfly, Black Betty, and The Yellow Dog, both of which were New York bestsellers. Last year, Easy Rollins returned to The Bad Boy of Raleigh Brown, Six Easy Pieces, and Fear Itself, the follow-up to Fearless Jones, was published in January of 2004. Little Scarlet, which we all received, and Easy Rollins' novel set 5 days after the 65 Watts riots, was published in July of 2004. And in 2005, our mystery writer published his first book for young adults, 47, an ingenious mix of history, science fiction, and adventure. He's also written 3 works of literary fiction, R.L.'s Dream, Always Outnumbered, Always Outgunned, and Walking the Dog. 2 works of science fiction, Blue Light and the Future Land, and 2 works of nonfiction, Working on the Chain Gang and What Next? 2 movies have been made of his work, including the 1995 TriStar release of Devil in a Blue Dress, and also starring Denzel Washington and Jennifer Beals, Always Outnumbered, starring Lawrence Fishburne, Natalie Cole, and Cicely Tyson. His short fiction has been published in a wide array of publications, including The New Yorker, GQ, Esquire, USA Weekend, Los Angeles Times, and The Savoy. He's won numerous awards, including the Ansfield Wolf Award, an honor given to works that increase the appreciation and understanding of race in America. In 2002, he won a Grammy Award for his liner notes accompanying Richard Pryor's And It's Deep, Too. He was a finalist for the NAACP Award of Fiction and won the 1996 Black Caucus of America Library Association's Literary Award. He was an O. Henry Award winner in 1996. Recently, he was honored by the Robert Redford Sundance Institute with the Risk Taker Award, which is why he's here, by the way, and among other credits, given to him for both his creative and activist efforts. Also this year, he was honored with an honorary doctorate from City College. He created with City College a new publishing degree aimed at young urban residents. This is the first of this type of degree offered anywhere in the country. He serves on the board of directors of National Book Awards and presently serves on the boards of the Full Frame Documentary Film Festival, the Poetry Society of America and Trans-Africa, and is past president of the Mystery Writers of America. I'm also proud to say that he was born and raised here in Los Angeles, although he now chooses to live in New York City. It is no mystery of who I'm talking about. Ladies and gentlemen, will you please help me to welcome Mr. Walter Mosley.
Boy, there's still people here, you know. I've been watching people leave, you know, forever. I mean, all day. Like, ever since, like, yesterday morning, people with suitcases leaving. I thought, God, there was going to be anybody here. And I was happy, actually. Because then nobody would have to, you know, judge me. Yeah, it's really fun. Nobody's at that reserve table. whenever I give talks to people anywhere, I write them, and I write them for that place because it seems like it's like a responsibility, you know. And it's funny because I had finished doing it, and then I was talking to Claire, and she said, "Well, you know, you could just read from your work or, you know, talk about yourself." And I was like, "Wow, I could have, but now I've already written this thing." Luckily. It's not all that long. I mean, it's a little longish, but it's not all that long. And so what I'm going to do, and you know, correct me if I'm wrong in this. I'm going to talk to you a little bit. I'm going to read this talk to you, and then I'll entertain questions if there's time. And when it's over, you know, which you can tell me, Claire, you can tell me what you can, the hook or anything, pull me off. I'll sign books for people if you want me to. You know, I'll sit down at the reserve table, and. And I'll sign books if anybody wants, you know, wants me to sign their book. I mean, you got a free book, you might as well get a free signature, you know. The problem, though, with having written a talk, is like I really didn't know where I was going. I didn't know who was going to be here, really. I mean, I knew a name, you know, the grant, you know, givers, whatever. You know, I'm like, what does that mean? You know, I mean, like, you know, really, everybody gives grants, you know. And so, like, I didn't know, I didn't, so that was a funny thing. And now I've been here for a while, and I have a better notion of it. You know, very often I write political monographs, and my political monographs are always come from the point of view is that I don't know. Like, I'm not an expert on foreign policy, but I know that the people who are experts are murderers, and so therefore, it's better me saying it than them saying it. Because I'll say, I don't think children should die. They say their bombs are smart, you know, that kind of notion, you know, too smart to kill children. And that notion in a funny way is being here because I'm among a lot of people who know a lot and they know so much. It's hard for me to kind of understand sometimes what you've been talking about. You know, I'll say, well, I think this should happen. So, oh, that's already happened. I say, I didn't know that. You know, and it's very funny, and but it's anyway. That's a comment for you to digest any way you wish. I thought I should tell you a little bit about myself in my relationship to you. I mean, you have this introduction of me as a writer, which some people consider art, and other people don't. But. So I think I should tell you a little bit about myself, about who I am. You have to understand, I want to thank actually Ken Brecker for making it possible for me to come here in the first place, approaching me at Sundance and ask me. And it's a funny thing because I listened to Ken give a talk yesterday and it has a lot. And then when I went back to my room this morning and I reread my talk, I realized it has a lot to do with what he was talking about, which is about borders. But anyway. I want to talk to you a little bit about who I am in reference to grant makers before I tell you this thing. And so I decided that I would, first I would tell you a story about a poet, and then I would tell you how I myself try to fund the arts. And so that might make a relationship between us, and then I can talk about the rest of this thing. Many years ago, many, many years ago, before I was ever published, I went to the Dodge Poetry Festival in New Jersey. And there was a panel of poets, and they were talking about the life of the poet. Three of the poets, Carolyn Forché, Lucille Clifton, and Ruth Stone, spoke first. Ruth Stone, who's very poor, lives in Vermont, talked about grants as far as, well, that grant got me a washing machine, and that grant got me my Oldsmobile. And, you know, that was her life as a poet. Lucille Clifton was talking about how she was homeless when she was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. And Carolyn Forché talked about meeting with a dictator, you know, rebel, a dictator in South America who had in his drawer a bag of the ears of his enemies. And this was how, you know, how I was supposed to become a poet. And I was thinking, my God, if I have to do all this, I don't want to be a poet. It sounds too hard. Then Etheridge Knight came up. Now, I don't know if anybody knows who Etheridge Knight is. Etheridge Knight is one of America's greatest poets ever. And Etheridge, you know, if you know his life, Etheridge spent much of his life in prison. And so his life was actually a lot harder than these other three people sitting next to him. And he said, how did I become a poet? He said, well, you know, he says, well, I became a poet. I was in the penitentiary. And when I was in the penitentiary, I defined myself as a poet. And after I defined myself as a poet, I went to the library to figure out what it was I had become. It was the most generous, wonderful thing I had heard. Etheridge was telling me that it was possible for me to become, regardless of where I am or what was against me or what was on top of me, etc. That's a really important thing to know. And he, more than anyone else, said, yeah, you can be a writer. It's okay. I never talked to him. I'm scared of Etheridge. But I said, wow, man, this guy's letting me be. I want to talk to you about the organizations that I've given to and that I've supported as a supporter of the arts. Nothing I'll mention have I given less than $5,000 to. I think anything less than that, you know, is just kind of, well, you know, fundraising, kind of like, well, I gave you $10. But and I'm going to tell you a couple of stories about those things just so you understand me. I give to the Sundance Foundation because once the Sundance Foundation brought me in and tried to show me how to write screenplays. I don't know if they were successful, but they were very nice to me. And I thought I should be giving them money. It's always been an important thing to me because it seems like artists should be the first people funding the arts. I think if you're part of it, if you're an artist, if you're not like funding the arts, you're not working toward funding the arts, you're not doing that, then, you know, I don't care about you. You know, so I might like your art, but, you know, don't start talking to me about funding. You know, I give to Goddard College because I went to Goddard College. They kicked me out, but they should have kicked me out, and I thought that was a good thing they did. And so I always give back to them. There's a group called Cave Canem, which I'll talk about later. And then I decided one day, I realized that there are many ways that you can impact things. Because the amount of money you give, there's never enough charity in the world. As long as you need charity, your world's in trouble. There's never enough charity in the world. We should know that. But there are other ways to make things happen with money. I'm on the Full Frame advisory board. And I noticed one day that all the award they were giving, like Kodak was giving, you know, $500 for their award in film. So you figure they were making money on that, right? And they were making money on it. And I said, $500, Kodak, I don't care how much there's, you know, digital cameras, they could give more than that, you know? And so I decided I was going to give $5,000 for a thing I called the Seeds of War Award. It would be for two different films and documentaries. And I would give this award for those films that best express why war happens. Why war happens, and I'll give them money. And then, like, the money, they get $2,500, but the thing is, they've won an award. You know, nobody knows that it, you know, is an award I made up one night, you know. And I thought, you know, they said, wow, they won Seeds of War. That's a big thing, you know. That's all you have to do is say it's a big thing, and it's a big thing. And one time, two other things. One time, I had a friend who was a musical theater person and who couldn't support themselves. And I actually supported them for a year, and then they became really successful. I was very happy. The last thing is I joined the Met, you know, the Met, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and you know, if you pay them enough money, you get to go to the trustees' dining room and the other place. You can go to the fourth floor, and so, like, I gave them money. I look at it like it's my club, and I take people there. I have my business meetings there. I take people and we hang out there, you know, and they're very impressed. You know, I say, "Wow, you can get up to that floor?" And I say, "Yes." But the big thing, my moment of like charity, if that's the word I would use there, is I was at that time the only black person who was a member when I started. And they used to stop me. The guys used to stop me at the door. They'd say, "Excuse me, this goes to the members' room." And I'd say, "Yeah." And they'd say, "Have you been invited?" And I said, "Well, no." I said, "Well, you can't go." I said, "But I'm a member." And that lesson was so important for these guys who wanted to stop me. And it was not only guys, there's also people at another desk who, you know, everybody else, you would show your card, me, they would go check my card. They'd say, oh, well, let me go check your card. And, you know, they're not like really racist people. I mean, they have an inferior African art department, but... but they don't know any better. You know what I mean? They have an inordinate American, like, section, you know, but, like... You ever go there, you go to the Met, and you know, like it's a Sunday, and there are like 10,000 people there, but all of them are in the European art section. You go to China, and like there's like tumbleweeds blowing through there, you know. And it's beautiful, you know, it's like incredible stuff. But anyway, and when I tell you these things, I just want you to understand how I do or do not identify with what you guys are doing. You know, I mean, I don't even know. I mean, I think some people might agree with me, some people might not. But that's kind of where I kind of felt like finally, well, I could come here because I believe in supporting the arts. You know, I think that we have to, but supporting it is how we do that. There are different ways that we might do it. And so I wrote this essay. It's called Art for the People. I'm going to read it to you because I'm a writer. Writers think. I have friends, you know, like Cornel West, who can actually just be extemporaneously say things, but I can't remember the right things to say at the right moment, and so I always read out loud. About a decade ago, I found myself in Australia on a reading tour, and at some point, I attended a speech given by a political supporter of the group that brought me over. He spoke in simple, declarative sentences with only the slightest Australian accent. I understood every word he said, but the speech would make no sense to me whatsoever, no matter how much I concentrated on it. After each sentence was over, I couldn't have repeated what he said. There was no meaning to his words, but still, at the end of the oration, everybody, including myself, applauded politely. I realized that he was being political in the diplomatic sense, that it was his intention to gather universal, if weak, praise by not saying anything that might stick in anyone's mind or anyone's craw. You won't have that problem with me today. My words will have meaning to you. And some of you will nod and hear my ideas and say, yes, of course, and others will be disgusted and maybe leave before I finish. I doubt if anyone will be wholly unaware of the testimony I give here, but maybe a few will see a different logic and even a different approach that might be taken, and maybe not. A while ago, I became very interested in the notion of finding a context with which to create an opposite pole to stand against the forces of capital, those forces that so dominate the bodies, hearts, and souls of billions of human beings living and suffering in today's world. I wanted to create a kind of anti-prism through which many like-minded people could see a clear and compelling goal that they might agree on, a simple principle that would stand for the rights of the 5-year-old child soldier in Uganda, the 11-cent-an-hour laborer in China, and the poor sod who knows the hurricane is coming but has no power and no help to get out of the way. The context for a social movement has to be a subtle and simple device that appears to be straightforward and uncomplicated, but which in reality touches a deep note within the hearts, histories, and even the instincts of many millions. The kind of context I'm talking about is usually contained in a phrase no more than a few words long. Never again. Take back the night. End apartheid now. We shall overcome. It is not only liberals and the political left who have such phrases. The simple word profit is the capitalist credo. And the right to life is another powerful, if conservative, battle cry. I look out at this world and see devastation on all sides. From the 5 million dead in Congo in less than a decade to the forgotten stacks of skulls in Cambodia to the disproportionate millions of Americans of color who are either in prison on their way back there or bound to go there from the day that they're born. Bob Dylan once wrote a song in which he enumerated all of the things that were broken in our world. Treaties, social services, relationships, roads, faith. At one point he says, take a deep breath, feel like you choking. Everything is broken. This is how I feel about the world that I live in. I look around and see inadequate medical care, working women and men with little to no chance for a comfortable retirement, and deficient education for those who can't afford better, no matter how promising they may be. We have the continuing hurricane-like disasters of rising rents, ever higher unemployment and underemployment, and a level of preparedness that at the best of times favors only the wealthy. We experience disasters only to create greater turmoil. We respond to terrorism by declaring war, which in its worst manifestation is only organized terrorism. When the Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, Fidel Castro offered to send troops and medical professionals to help. He was refused. This refusal was, to me, a twofold tragedy. First of all, Cuba's well-trained army and medical professionals might have saved the lives of some poor Americans left to fend for themselves in a nation that has a liberal social agenda coupled with a conservative economic program. But that wasn't the worst thing. Not at all. Allowing Cuba to help us would have been a small step toward world peace. When enemies put aside their differences for humanitarian concerns, the world turns toward a brighter day. Instead, we turn toward darkness. Instead, we kept the status quo, allowed unnecessary deaths, kept the possibility for growing conflict in Central America, South America, as well as Asia, the Middle East, and of course, and always, in Africa. Discovering a context to unite people of America and the rest of the world seemed to me like the only possible road worth considered traveling. If only I could come up with those few words that would galvanize those millions around us in the world who know that injustice rules almost everywhere. But locating the concept upon which those words would be founded has proven a difficult, if not an impossible, task. Not because there is no such concept. Indeed, there are dozens, maybe hundreds of issues that are salient and urgent for our nation and the rest of the globe. From ecology to terrorism to slave labor to endless wars, Mr. Dillon's words were not wrong. Young black women in America's southeast have a disproportionately high level of HIV infections, while youth gangs in and out of prison are warring across the nation. There's obesity, drug addiction, alcoholism, profiling, sexism, a lawless war in the Middle East where many thousands have died when not one of them was guilty of a crime against our nation. Self-named African Americans who have yet to unite and stand against the tragedies unfolding in Africa every day. Our children tell us what they feel by using angry words and the tones of rap music. We do not heed the Africans. We do not heed our own children. Instead, we blame the youth for wanting expensive shoes and clothes and jewelry, never asking about who is selling them their precious bling, who is advertising to them, co-opting sports stars and rap moguls, exploiting worldwide slave labor and making billions on their recordings, concerts, exploits, and Wall Street appearances. There are too many issues. Too many groups committed to one or another movement. I have spoken to many ignorant Westerners who denigrate the African political scene because of their supposed adherence to tribalism. They are slaves, the Westerners say, to this primitive system of social organization and can therefore never come together and unite like we do here in the West. But what are we but fractured groups of helpless whiners? We call ourselves the most advanced nation in the world. We pride ourselves on our freedoms, our democracy, and our sense of fair play. But at the same time, we fight terrorism by waging an unjust war. We call the Republican and Democratic parties, which in my opinion are little more than interest corporations, we call that the fount of democracy. We torture Islamic prisoners in Guantanamo while keeping in place a murderous embargo on Cuba for their infractions on human rights. We have abandoned the poor here and in Haiti and Sudan and Chad and Afghanistan and Mexico and China. We should never forget China. I know, or at least I think I know, what some of you might be thinking. What does this have to do with private philanthropic organizations whose goal it is to promote art, artists, art organizations, and culture? You would think that I was addressing the Socialist Party or maybe a meeting of the International Union members or possibly even that exquisite oxymoron, the Anarchist Convention. I find, though, that I cannot discuss the utilization of the power and wealth convened here in this hall without presenting the problems as I see them. I have to talk about Congo and East Harlem, the Middle Passage, which is not yet over, and the war, if I want to address the possibility of context for our potentials and goals in this world. I, and this is definitely true, I am not a religious man, not in the least. You could be sure of that. Not only am I agnostic, but even truth for me, as I grow older, becomes more and more a relative term, something I aspire to with no expectations of arrival. I mention my lack of faith in these areas because of the two questions that came to mind when I decided to accept the offer to come and speak to you. These interconnected questions are, one, what is art to me? And two, what do I see as the purpose of art in the world today? They're very big questions, very, very philosophical. But without them, and their cogent answers, there is no reason for any kind of organized approach to promoting art, whatever that means. Maybe you like the color blue, or poetry that rhymes, or pornographic pictures of nudes in the back rooms of museums. There's no reason to travel to L.A. if art for you is merely an aesthetic, a form, a contest in which we decide who is the best. History will decide that no matter what we say, and even history has been known to change its mind at times. When I ask myself, the agnostic scribbler, what is art, I am amazed at the answer that comes back instantly and continually from deep inside my heart. That is, art is the conduit to God on earth. And that conduit has other names: spirit, hope, faith, and the courage to look at the world and see in it something that is true, no matter how ugly that truth is, no matter how much that truth might indict its teller. Artists are our truth tellers. Their faith is to a higher calling, or at least, in the best of worlds, it should be. From this point of view, there is no greater or lesser art. Because here, art is not ego, but only language, interconnectedness, humanity beyond the borders of nationalism, chauvinism, and even capitalism. I am amazed that this is my true feeling, that I believe in a metaphysical aspect of art when I am such a positivist in my everyday life. But when I look at the Aboriginal art of Australia or the comic books of America today, I definitely see how we are reaching out beyond ourselves with this extraordinary talent for creativity that we all have. When I listen to Thelonious Monk or Johann Sebastian Bach, I hear something beyond my ability to comprehend. Their music makes me want to laugh because it transforms me once again into the child who realizes that there is so much to learn and see and celebrate. In other words, there is so much more to come. And so it comes to me, somewhere along this path of contemplation, that God on earth for me is a metaphor for the metaphysical good that comes from this wide-eyed desire, excited by the possibilities of art. So I suppose for me that art is the conduit for good, or at least the potential for good. It is beauty. Like water for the woman who has been lost in a desert. Like sex for the adolescent who has been lost in childhood. Like sleep for the man who has labored his entire life. Also, like the feeling of revenge someone has when the lie that has been perpetrated against him for all these years has finally been shown for what it is. This beauty is like mourning for the old couple who have so long supped each evening with death. And so I see the support of art as a support for the way to connect us to our true and hopeful truth and hopefully deliver us from our oppression. This, of course, brings us to the problem with having somebody like me addressing those organizations, many of whom represent a great part of the wealth of the world today. You see, if you haven't figured it out, I also see art as a decidedly anti-capitalist tool, a means of exposing and overcoming those elements that co-opt and undermine everything from free expression to universal, which is to say free, health care. This aspect of anti-capitalism is not, in my opinion, necessarily socialist or communist. I also see the democratic spirit as being, in its nature, anti-capitalist. I mean, democracy is the will of the people, where capitalism is the will of the few people who own the resources that everyone else needs to survive. This is just as true with the commodity of art as it is with the commodity of petroleum. Art is snapped up by the wealthy and the corporations. Artists are snapped up just as handily. True expression is limited by the arbiters of the so-called free market. And if you want the space and time to be an artist, you will have to deal with the money men of every stripe and persuasion. In America, this is especially true if you don't happen to be fluent in the language of white, Christian, Eurocentric culture. This is the abomination that reflects so exactly the world that I talked about at the beginning of the speech. The wars, the poverty, the diseases, and all the ailments rife in poor communities around the nation and the globe. The application of wealth makes the artist jump through hoops like a trained dog until the day that dog breaks its leg or follows its true instincts, ripping out the throat of its master or, more likely, its master's number one boy. The other day, I was speaking to one of jazz's foremost bass players. He told me that there was a truly excellent horn player that he hadn't seen for some years, and then one day he sees this guy pushing a United States mail cart. The bass player asked his friend, "What had happened?" "I just gave up," the horn player answered. "I just couldn't make it blowing that horn. And you know, I got health insurance and retirement with this gig here." The horn player was one of the lucky ones. At least he got to play for a while. At least he was aware of what he was giving up. For a few minutes there, he had been part of the dialogue of art. There are many who never know that there's something missing. There are many who are silenced before they learn how to speak. And this way, in these ways, we discard art every day. All of those black and brown children in the ghettos of this land and many others, how many of them could have said something before they became gang-related? Before they were defeated by the exigencies of everyday life. And make no mistake about it, gang membership is not a choice. It is a necessity for emotional and physical survival in a zone where the law that protects us does not exist. Whenever I talk about these things, I hear my smug middle class or so-called middle class peers tell me whose fault it is. It's the parents, they say, while secretly believing that their privileged children are actually smarter than those brutal ghetto-dwelling descendants of slaves. The parents don't understand education, they say. And so the children run wild. And for a moment, I realize that what they're saying is true. That there is a lack of education. That our children are ignorant of the truth and the true values of life. But these truths and values do not reside in our educational institutions. And they never have. Learning to read will not make you a better person, necessarily. Getting a college degree won't make you make... getting a college degree won't make sure that you don't support genocide. It may give you the veneer of innocence, but when the Allies break down our defenses and overrun our borders, we may find ourselves on trials for war crimes despite our dissertations on Dante and Da Vinci. It is our job to make sure that the true language of art is available to as many people as possible. We must break down hierarchies of art. We must turn away from the commodification of art. We must open communications between artists in Rwanda and Rhode Island, Monaco and Mongolia. We must give all of our children paintbrushes and pottery wheels, tape recorders and condoms if they need them. We have to listen to the words of anger and frustration that young people are mouthing around the world, and we must pay attention to the war being waged against the poorest and weakest among us. You might say, well, is Walter saying that this is political? No, no, no. There's a revolutionary onus on us as the funders of painters and classical musicians and poets. Are you saying that art at its base is the fulcrum for social change? Yes, I am. And not only that, sometimes we will have to give someone a hot dog before we give them a paintbrush. Sometimes we might even have to give a child a kiss before asking them to speak of their experiences killing other children when they were only 9 years old. Sometimes we will have to contradict the jailers before we can see the outsider art of America's alternative university, the penal system. I was asked some years ago to go to the UN and to read for Salman Rushdie, from Salman Rushdie's work in order to show my solidarity with the artist under the threat of fatwa. I told my sponsors at the American branch of a prominent international writers organization that I would be glad to do such a thing. I thought that the death sentence on Mr. Rushdie's head was an abomination. But I had a holdback. I wanted us also to apologize for our government's support of the Shah and the thousands who were tortured and killed under our watch. This, for me, was simple logic. You have to attempt to understand the motivation of your enemies. You have to remove yourself from nationalist self-interest if you are an artist. Artist for the good of everyone, for all people. The writers' organization refused my holdback. We're a writers' organization, they told me. It was amazing. They said, we're a writers' organization. I said, well, these people read. You know? It's all good and well to give money to the edifices of art, the museums and opera houses, the Yale graduates who struggle profoundly to keep ancient Greek theater alive. It is wonderful when we find another Mozart or Picasso and we whisper their names in awe. But that murdering, whoring child from Uganda is also part of the language of art. He utters words and truths that no one wants to hear. He is lost, and there is no one looking for him. He is gang-related in L.A., not 20 miles from where we sit. He is crippled outside of a Chinese production plant. She is suffering from a U.S. embargo less than 100 miles from our borders. She is on her knees before Western genitalia, learning to smile while holding her breath. For me, art is transformative before it is an object of adoration, like language. What we are told is more important than the one who speaks. It is our duty to find the truth tellers and the form breakers in their hovels and their limited but wholly new perspectives. We have to reach out beyond our borders for the people who are looking for us, but who do not know that they are looking, and they do not know who we are. We must create beacons standing out in the darkness that envelops so many, calling them home to a home that they've never even suspected exists. I understand that the words that I'm saying are abstract. I know I'm coming down heavily on the political side of the agenda. So let me try to give you a small example from my own experience. Over a decade ago, the extraordinary African-American poets Cornelius Eady and Toy Derricott were part of a group that was on holiday in Italy. They were bemoaning the white Eurocentric domination of writing programs in the United States. This new phenomenon on university campuses across the country excluded students of color in various ways. To begin with, most of these programs have nothing to do with art. They are there to collect the many thousands of dollars that students are willing to pay to sit in the room with a real writer. $30,000, $40,000, the sums are ridiculous. One student pays enough in a year to cover the one adjunct professor's salary. And we're all adjuncts, you know. And here are so many impoverished and talented black writers and potential writers. Also, these programs know nothing of the history and the art and the struggle of non-white students who don't exist in their program. So Cornelius and Toya said, well, let's start a program of our own. We'll call it Cafe Canem, you know, it's in Latin and we're in Italy, so we'll do that. And we'll make it so that it costs little to nothing for every deserving black poet who wants to belong. They made up a 3-year program where students did work year-round and then once annually got together for a week to work with the most exceptional African-American poets alive today. They had no university, no building or permanent residence. They had and have no accreditation. But every year for the past decade, those students and later others have come together with Toy and Cornelia, Sonia Sanchez, Elizabeth Alexander, Kwame Brathwaite, and others. Some of the most important young poets in America come out of this program. They are loved and feted, published and promulgated, seen by their peers and praised by their elders. I've been twice to see what this summer program is like. And I'm always amazed by the intensity and the creativity of the 100 or more poets. I give them money. I tell everybody about them. This institution is wholly unique in my experience of creative writing institutions, but despite this, they're not very well known. They're not supported as an alternative to the greedy machinations of colleges and universities around the country. They struggle to survive even when Toy and Cornelius have run the group for 10 years without one dime in recompense. I once sat next to a man who had just given $40 million to opera that year. There's nothing wrong with that. But there is a problem with black and Hispanic groups cannot find proper funding even when they show that they will put what little they have on the line for what is good in art. I go to funding and support groups all the time complaining about the lack of support in the arts community for people of color and the poor. I am told, more often than not, that the people in question do not apply. They do not make themselves known. They do not make the effort, and they are not interested. This happens with grants, prizes, memberships, and the perceived levels of quality and talent of those outsiders. It seems to me that many of the people and organizations who give money to promote art have not yet found direct avenues to those of us in the world who are not part of the cultural and capitalistic hierarchical structures of art funding. Those of us who are trying to say something but don't have the proper forms or read the right newspapers. Those of us who have not isolated art from the other parts of our lives, because certainly there's a professional attitude that greatly services artists and would-be artists in this world. Very often in the black community, political convention and artistic expression go hand in hand. I remember once years ago when we had a different president with the same name as the current one. Quincy Troop, one of our extraordinary poets, was regaling a group of young black poets, and he said to them, poetry is not just something you have on your mind or even in your heart. You might write, I hate Bush. Now, that might be right, but it ain't poetry. Art, in its nature, is a revolutionary act. It challenges how we see our world. Rembrandt revolted against his benefactors to make them common people in his paintings. Goya was a master of the political cartoon. Picasso refused to turn to Spain when it was under fascist rule. The job of art is to show the many truths that we suffer and battle against. Art is nothing if not revolutionary. It is not nostalgia. It is not the status quo. It is not the comfortable repetition of once great artists whose battles were over before they breathed their last. And so, in summation, What I am asking of you, what am I asking of you? I am asking you to take up arms and join the art revolution in the prisons, among the farm workers, in the gangs of the inner city, and for those who have no voice but with every iota of their strength, they deny the TV dominion over their lives. I'm asking you to open the borders and welcome in those that have stones in their pathways and blood on their hands. Thank you. Thank you. I tell you, I worried a long time about this speech, but I was never moved by it. It's funny. So, well, these are all just facts. But when I'm standing up here, I actually believe it, you know. So for a little bit, if anybody has any, like, you know, I know, because I know, like, everybody's saying, yeah, but what about E.Z. Rollins, you know? If anybody has anything to ask me or to bring up or to respond, I'd be happy to talk for a while. Yes? Sure. I misspelled Salman's name, though, you know. He's a very nice guy. I wouldn't want his name, so I have to, fix it up. But, yeah, I'd be happy to, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's a very difficult thing, you know. One of the things that I've learned as being a writer is that I'm often finding myself in dialogue. I used to be a computer programmer, and when I would talk to people, they say, "Walter, shut up, we got work to do. We can't be talking about, you know." I remember I was watching Shoah. I remember that thing about the concentration camps. It's like that long thing that guy did, that French guy, the existentialist asshole. But it's a great film, and I would go to work and I'd say, "Hey, man, did you see that thing? You know, you hear what they did? Did you hear about the guy from Spain? Did you?" And they would say, "Shut up, stop talking." And so I know that the fact of allowing people to talk, to dialogue, and to continue that makes them more intelligent, because they become facile in the language. And if there's any feeling behind it, it makes a difference. And so, having written this, I'd be happy to put it out in the world, and, you know, and to have people argue with me, the former Bush or the present one. Anything else? Yes. A Red Death was done as a stage play in Chicago by a group, and I forgot the name of the company that did it, and it's done as a radio. Black Betty and White Butterfly have been done as radio plays in Los Angeles. Yes. Are you planning to go visit the New Orleans area or Louisiana and write about this? I haven't been thinking about going, because I mean I don't really know what I would do. I mean, I think I would cause more. I think I'd be like detracting from things rather than adding to things. I mean, I've sent money, I've sent books, you know, you belong to various organizations that are doing things about it. You know, but the thing about Katrina's for me is interesting, you know, because people talk to me about it, you know, and, you know, I've just been on a book tour, so I've been all over the country. And, you know, people like to talk to me because I talk like this. Like, they'll ask me about my book and I'll start talking about the Congo. They love that, you know, because they don't really want you to try to sell stuff. You know, but they are busy selling themselves. And so everybody is always asking me, so what do you think about Katrina? And I'm sitting there listening, and I know that they're saying it because of their advertisers, not because they want to educate their audiences. They say, well, this is the big thing. And it's like, what about OJ? You know, it's like, nobody cares about OJ. You know, but people want to watch the television, and the advertisers like it a lot. So whenever anybody asks me about Katrina, they say, what do you think about Katrina? I say, I think in the last 7 years, 5 million people have died in Congo. And they go, huh? I say, right, exactly. You're not asking about that. And I feel like a lot of people are doing things about Katrina. Look, what do I think about Katrina? I think that 100,000 people just died in Pakistan, and the American population isn't rising up trying to raise money to help those people. They help people from the tsunami. They help people in Katrina because that's positive. That's kind of like this positive thing going on. But if we were helping people in Pakistan, we would be making the world a better place. It would be two steps. It would be helping those people, but it would also be people who think they're enemies, helping each other, saying, hey, I want to reach beyond this. But America doesn't do that. And so it's not that I don't worry about Katrina and that I don't want to do things about it, but I think that people use it to occlude the real issues going on, even with Katrina itself. I think that, you know, that nobody's really making a difference. And I mean, because there are all kinds of questions get brought about Katrina. The main one is having a liberal social conscience with a conservative economic agenda. That's the problem. That's what I think about Katrina. That, you know, we got, you know, Bush, Clinton, all of them, you know, since Carter, who impoverish. I mean, they take away the safety net for the poor. And that's been happening for 20 years in America. And that's the problem with Katrina. Nothing else is the problem. I mean, Katrina happened. It's over, you know. I mean, okay, yeah, pay, do organizations, try to get people, you know, be like Carlton here and, you know, really, you know, work with what happened afterwards to the people who got displaced. But there are other issues, and the other issues, you know, we should be smarter than that. Americans. Yes, I promise not to sound mean anymore.
I actually didn't take your speech that way or your essay that way at all. It actually reminded me so much of why I love this particular gathering.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree. You know, The Night by Elie Wiesel, you know, the first book that he wrote coming out of the concentration camp. The thing that made that book, the reason I think that they should have given him the Peace Prize, you know, because they would never give him a literary prize, but the reason they should have given it to him is because he talks about his collusion as a human being. That when somebody took food from his father's hand and put it into his hand, he could have held it, but he ate it. And from that, there was a moment of guilt. And to understand, but in guilt, there's also responsibility. And if you can say, that means you can do, if you have responsibility, you can do something. You have the power to do something. And I think that that's what's so wonderful. And I completely agree. I completely agree with that. You know, I do think that there's a lot that we don't think about, though. And there's a lot, and especially in America, where we can be bedazzled by things and think we're doing something when indeed we're not. You know, can you imagine only one person in Congress voted against the war, the invasion of Iraq? And I think only one person in Congress has a kid who's in the Army. You know, it's kind of funny, not the same person. It is a very big world to look at and to understand our responsibility, which is why I've begun to say the so-called African American, because, you know, if we're going to take the name, we have to take the responsibility of Africa also. Can't just call ourselves African Americans and turn our back on the Congo. Anything else? Notions, ideas? Things about movies? Yes?
Could you talk a little bit more about excellence and judging and the arts? And you talked about it a little bit. You talked about an award that you give out and many people in this room mandated. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I was talking about that the other day when we were like on that panel. You know, what's the most important thing about art? You know, painting. The negative space, right? It's the negative space. It's not like the subject. It's where the subject is in relation to the pain. What's the negative space? You know, the negative space is those people who appreciate art, who read art, who understand art, who are profoundly moved by art and changed by it. You know, that's a truth. That's the truth. That's the truth in the painting. If it's true in the painting, it has to be true everywhere else. That's the way that I understand it. Years and years ago, I was an assistant for Bruno Bettelheim, who was addressing a group of 200 people. And you know, Bruno was crazy. He was crazy. He was really smart. And all these teachers, you know, they were, you know, like everybody who's in a group, you know, they congratulate themselves. I did this, I did that. And he said, listen, all you people have been talking to me about, you had these special programs for genius children. He said, listen, you can't stop a genius child from reading. You would have to stop them. All you need to do is put them in a room with some books. You know, they're smarter than you are. What do you think you're doing? It's this vast middle that's so important. You know, but you're ignoring them because you feel happy having support. Yeah, I supported Picasso. Really. I mean, what's Picasso going to say about that? Say, what, you think you made me an artist? You know? I mean, you know, it's like, I supported Miles Davis. What? I mean, really, honestly. You know, say, I don't need your support. You give me some money. Yeah, but you didn't support me. You didn't make me. You didn't, you know, that's the notion. The thing is to create that environment in which art can flourish, right? Because you can't be Mozart all by yourself. Somebody has to build a violin. Somebody has to have a notion of the notes and the progression and stuff like that. You can't just be born and just automatically have all that. There's a language, and that language is that's our job, right? Our job is the whole language of art, bringing all of that together. So all these people come and, you know, and people rise out of Mozart rises and Thelonious Monk rises, you know, and, you know, Picasso, you know, these people. And that's what it's about. That's how I see it. You know, it's not like you have to give awards, but maybe the awards, you know, you figure out how the awards include the people who love the work. You know, my award to you is this $100,000 in which you will be able to bring this knowledge of yours to this group of people. Those kinds of things, you know. And also the thing that Ken was talking about so wonderfully yesterday about all those people, you know, all those child soldiers in Uganda, you know, who don't even know they have something to say, who don't even know this world of art and museums and possibility exists. You know, we put billions of dollars into Afghanistan in order to wreck the Russian economy. And as soon as it was over, we just left. When the Taliban rose and Osama bin Laden came in, Afghanistan was the poorest country on the face of the earth. We did that. We did that. But, you know, there's rules on your organizations. Well, you can't help these people. Damn, where the fuck did you get your money from if you didn't get it from those people? I mean, or you look at Africa. This is something. It has something to do with art, but, it, you know, kind of like in that negative space thing. Africa. People have meetings in which they discuss forgiving the debt to Africa. Between the Islamic and Christian incursions over the last 8 centuries, when we have taken people, language, culture, natural resources, we've destroyed the whole continent, and people with no embarrassment say, let's forgive what they owe us. You know what I mean? It's like unbelievable. We owe them. They don't owe us anything. But the guy we put in power signed the power of attorney, and then he borrowed the billion, and now he has to pay it back. He said, but that was your friend. That was your friend. You put him in power. But at the same time, if I ask your organization, I don't know what it is, you know, but if I ask you to go to give money to Africans to support them, to bring them up, you know, somebody above you who's making money from Africa right at this very moment will say, oh, no, this money is not for them. We have to break down those borders. Because if we don't break down those borders, you know, everything we do is a lie. Right? Rather than being true, everything we do is a lie. Movies? Books? Mysteries? Short stories? Comic books? Yes? I have an answer for that. It has nothing to do with art. I don't like driving. You know, when you're in L.A., I was telling somebody this earlier, you know, like, you know, because I'm here all the time. You know, I got to do, you know, do movie stuff and book tours and stuff. And I come here, and a guy says, well, we're going down to USC. I said, okay, fine. How long will that take? He said, well, I don't know. Somewhere between 25 minutes and an hour and a half. And I said, well, does it get further away sometime? Is it like a planet going around? You know? Said, no, it just depends on the traffic, you know? I can't stand it. You know, in L.A., I want a stick of gum, right? I love L.A., but I want a stick of gum. So, okay, was there enough gas in the car to go get my stick of gum? You know, in New York, you know. If it's any time between, you know, 7 o'clock in the morning and 11 o'clock at night, I have to walk a block. If it's later, I have to walk 2 blocks to get my gum. And, you know, I like that. That's those New Yorkers out there. Have I done everything? Yeah, yes, absolutely. Huh? Where's Primo? Was he not in Cinnamon Kiss? You're talking about my character in the E.Z. Rollins novels. So where is he, you ask?
I haven't seen or read of
him. Oh, he wasn't in the newest book, Cinnamon Kiss, but he was in Little Scarlet. He was in Little Scarlet. Primo's, you know, E.Z. and Primo hang out. You know, I'd say that. But to say something about that, the question, you know, Primo is this guy. He's a Mexican guy. He's married to a Panamanian woman named Flowers, very, 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 very black-skinned woman. And he kind of moves back and forth between that border that Ken was talking about yesterday. Sometimes he's way down in Mexico, you know. Sometimes he's at this house. And E.Z. likes Primo. And for me, when I was raised in L.A., when I was a kid in the 50s, there were two races. There was white people, and then there was the rest of us. There was white people, and there was the rest of us. And it wasn't until after the Watts riots that the rest of us split up. I mean, really, if you were Chinese, if you were Japanese, if you were from Mexico, if you were black, you're all the same. You were all brothers. You all worked together. It was all the same thing. We talked in the same way. We started to look like each other. I couldn't even tell. I'd see one guy say, oh, that Mexican guy. And I said, no, that's a Japanese guy. You know, this, no, I, that Chinese guy. No, you know, and it was like, because everybody was like, you know, because we talked alike, we acted alike, we, you know. And so to bring Primo and also Jesus into Easy's life was to reflect that relationship, which still exists in L.A., but they lie about it in the newspapers and the radios. And they lie because saying that black people and Koreans are getting along doesn't sell newspapers. I mean, it's not a good enough reason to lie, but it works for capitalism. You know, well, you know, Jews and blacks hate each other. Well, my mother and my father, you know, my mother's Jewish, my father's black, and they might hate each other, but here I am, you know. And they said, well, you know what I mean. I said, yeah, I know what you mean, but I think you're lying, you know. I said that to a woman once on the radio. Boy, she got so upset. She said, I have proof. I said, you don't have no fucking proof. You just listened to another radio show, you know, and you wrote it down. The blacks and the Jews, you know. I'm looking around. I like answering. I do like actually like talk. I like answering questions more. I like talking. You're pointing at someone? Whoever. Yeah. Oh, hi.
We talked yesterday about how video is changing everything.
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Could you expand on the question just a little?
So what words and language and telling stories is really, really important.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I mean, it becomes an interesting thing. I think there are a lot of reasons. I mean, one, a lot of people already want to tell stories. I mean, so that they're kind of easy. Well, let me help you. You know, there are a lot of people who have stories to tell but don't believe that they have the ability or the talent to do it. Those people have to be kind of cajoled into it. The approach I would take, and I don't think this is the only approach, is the grassroots organizing approach. find out what somebody wants and then help them do that thing. You go into a community and say, well, you know, I'm trying to organize the community politically. They say, what does that mean? They say, what do you want? So, well, you know, we have a very dangerous crosswalk here. And people, you know, children are getting killed, you know, regularly. I say, well, so what you want is you want a stop sign. Or maybe you want a signal. So, okay, that's what we're going to do. And you get the community together and you build that signal. You can do that on a group level. You can do that on an individual level. You know, what do you want to do? I want to sing. I want to, you know, whatever it is, you know, it doesn't matter. I want to be in a TV show. Well, in order to have a TV show, you need a script. Let's get to work. What story are we going to tell? I'm going to tell a story about my mama. You know, that, whatever it goes. That's the way I would come at it. Though I think there are a lot of ways to do it. And I don't think, I don't know if I've said this, but, you know, one of the things that really interests me about being here, considering what this whole meeting is about, right? I'm, and one of the most ignorant people in the room. There may be somebody in here as ignorant as I am, but, you know, I'm sure most of the other people have better answers to that question than I do. You know, but that's how I would approach it. Am I finished? I wrote a screenplay called Black Angel. And Mike Olmos, Eddie Olmos' son, is going to make it into a comic book, I think because he wants to make it into a movie. I took recently Fantastic Four number 1. I want to tell you this because I'm making an art book. I took Fantastic Four number 1, and I took every image and I made them big, really big. And then I convinced Marvel to put it in an art book. And it's coming out next month. And with an introduction for me explaining why I think that Jack Kirby and the Fantastic Four are one of, you know, as almost as important as rock and roll in America. And that's been a fun thing. I like doing it, but you know, really, when I respect an art, I don't compete in it. I said, man, this, you know, I watch Jack Kirby. I look at Jack Kirby's art. I said, damn, he's good. I can't even imagine how he does this, you know. And so I just kind of back away, you know, and enjoy it. You know, you had it. Charles Blakey, Man in My Basement, the literary novel that wasn't on my website. No, I'm finished with that book. I'm finished with that book. Yeah, I'm finished with him too. You know, it was a thing. You know, it was a thing. You know, this book I wrote called Man in My Basement. I don't know if anybody's read it. It's about there's a black man who lives on Long Island who has this big house, but he's about to lose it all. He's very kind of immature and silly, and a very rich, very evil white man rents his basement to imprison himself, to punish himself for crimes that he's committed. Because he's committed all these crimes, but he doesn't know a judge in the world who's worthy of judging him. And so he locks himself in this black man's basement, and they have a dialogue. The black man, the white man, Aniston Bennett, is an evil man who's not bad. And Charles Blakey, his warden, is an innocent man who's not good. And there's information that passes between them about how the world works. I wrote the book really for black Americans. I mean, like, anybody can read it. I mean, because, you know, it has those large concepts. But I wrote it because that's the lesson I think that we African Americans have to learn. We have to learn that there's a much bigger world. And even if we are victims, we're also victimizers. You know? I mean, the rest of America has to learn that they're victimizers. They don't feel like victims, but they also don't feel like victimizers. You know, but a whole bunch of America feels like victims. And being a victim, you kind of forgive yourself for buying Nikes. You forgive yourself for, you know, paying income tax to a country that's murdering Iraq. You know, but we can't forgive ourselves. And I think that's, you know, that's in a very simple way of talking about that novel. But because of it, Blakey has served his purpose. And to go back to him wouldn't make any sense to me. And it's very rare. Most people I do go back to. Socrates, Fortlow, Fearless Jones, E.Z. Rawlins. I mean, I'm writing about them again and again. You know, but, you know, they do different jobs. Well, listen, everybody, thank you very much.